Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners. So we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from John Russell and Brian Lynn. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, there is new hope for the future of a population of endangered butterflies in the American state of California. Last year, a count of the orange and black western monarchs reached a record low of about 1,900. But this year, butterfly counters are reporting tens of thousands more western monarchs. The insects live along California's central coast in winter. The nonprofit science group Xerces Society for Invertebrate Conservation carries out the official study every year. It just opened the first period of this year's count on November 13th. But it says early reports are positive. Serena Jepson is director of endangered species at Xerces Society. She says volunteer counters have reported the presence of as many as 50,000 monarchs in the last few weeks. Jepson says the finding is not a recovery, but we're really optimistic and just really glad that there are monarchs here, and that gives us a bit of time to work toward recovery of the Western monarch migration. In the 1980s, millions of Western monarchs gathered in trees from Northern California down to Western Mexico. Now, their wintering sites are mostly on California's central coast. Western monarch butterflies travel south from the Pacific Northwest to California each winter. They return to the same places and even the same trees where they gather. The monarchs usually arrive in California at the beginning of November. They spread across the country once warmer weather arrives in March. The Western monarch butterfly population has decreased by more than 99% since the 1980s. Another monarch population on the eastern side of the Rocky Mountains travels from southern Canada and the northeastern United States to spend the winter in western Mexico. Scientists estimate the monarch population in the eastern U.S. has fallen about 80% since the mid-1990s. Monarchs from across the West migrate yearly to about 100 wintering sites along central California's Pacific coast. One of the best known wintering places is the Monarch Grove Sanctuary in the city of Pacific Grove. Pacific Grove, California, known as Butterfly Town, USA, has worked for years to help the decreasing monarch population. The city holds a parade to celebrate the butterflies every October. It also bans human interference with the monarchs. The crime carries a $1,000 fine. Last year, no monarchs appeared in Pacific Grove. But this year, an early count found that more than 13,000 of the insects had moved in. Scientists do not know why the population increased this year. But Jepson said it is likely a combination of reasons, including better conditions on their breeding grounds. Monarch butterflies lack state and federal legal protection that could keep their territory from being destroyed. Last year, the butterflies were denied federal protection. But the insects are now among the candidates for listing under the Federal Endangered Species Act.
Scientists have been able to do a rare study into an important early stage of human development. They studied an embryo in its third week after fertilization, a moment in time that has previously been difficult to study. European researchers looked at one embryo that was 16 to 19 days old. It was donated by a woman who ended her pregnancy. Until now, experts said, researchers have not had a full understanding of this stage of development because human embryos at this level of development are difficult to get. Most women do not yet know they are pregnant at that time, and global rules have, until recently, forbidden growing human embryos in a lab beyond 14 days. The study appeared recently online in Nature, a scientific publication. The study looked at gastrulation, which begins about 14 days after fertilization and lasts a little more than a week. This is when the embryo is still about the size of a small seed. Shankar Srinivas of the University of Oxford was the lead researcher on the project. Srinivas described gastrulation as a process by which you have this kind of explosion of cell diversity. Srinivas, who worked with other researchers in the United Kingdom and Germany on the project, added that during gastrulation, different cells are formed. These cells, he explained, start to be positioned in different places to form the body and its organs. For many years, the so-called 14-day rule on growing embryos in the lab has guided researchers, with some places, including the United Kingdom, writing it into law. Earlier this year, the International Society for Stem Cell Research recommended easing the rule and allowing researchers to grow embryos past 2 weeks in some situations and after a tough review process. But the rule remains law in the UK. This research was not subject to the law because the embryo was not grown in a lab. But it is an example of the types of things scientists expect to learn more about if rules are eased. Researchers found different kinds of cells, including red blood cells and other cells that give rise to egg or sperm cells. But the researchers did not see neurons, Srinivas said, meaning embryos are not able, at this stage, to sense their environment. Oxford University officials said this stage of development has never been fully mapped out in humans before. The authors said they hope their work not only gives information about this stage of development, but also helps scientists learn about how to make stem cells into particular types of cells that can be used to help heal damage or disease. Robin Lovell-Badge, a stem cell expert at London's Francis Crick Institute who chaired the group behind the guidelines, said being able to culture human embryos beyond 14 days would be incredibly important to understand not just how we develop normally, but how things go wrong. I'm John Russell.
American Space Agency, NASA, is preparing to launch a spacecraft that will attempt to strike an asteroid to see how the crash affects the space object's path. The test mission is designed to demonstrate a possible method for changing the direction of asteroids that are considered threats to Earth. NASA is calling the world's first planetary defense mission the Double Asteroid Redirection Test, or DART. The DART spacecraft is set to launch November 24th aboard a SpaceX Falcon 9 rocket from Vandenberg Air Force Base in California. The DART spacecraft was built and is operated by the Johns Hopkins Applied Physics Laboratory in Maryland. The project is directed by NASA's Planetary Defense Coordination Office. The mission's target will be an asteroid called Dimorphos, part of a two-body asteroid system. Dimorphos is a small moonlet that orbits a larger asteroid named Didymos. Didymos is about 780 meters across, while Dimorphos is 160 meters. It is expected to take DART about a year to reach its target. Clayton Cashula is a mission manager for DART. He recently explained that the targeted asteroid system does not currently present any threat to Earth. Rather, the mission is meant to demonstrate a defensive method that could be used in the future if actual asteroid threats are identified. Cashula said the DART demonstration had been carefully designed to make sure the mission itself does not create a threat. NASA and its international partners continuously search the skies for what scientists call near-Earth objects. Such objects include asteroids and comets that come within 50 million kilometers of Earth's orbit. Scientists estimate there are billions of asteroids and comets orbiting our sun. NASA records show that about once a year, an asteroid around the size of an automobile enters Earth's atmosphere. Such objects turn into fireballs and burn up before reaching Earth's surface. About every 2,000 years, a much larger object strikes Earth and causes damage. But NASA experts say an object large enough to threaten Earth's civilization only comes along once every few million years. The DART spacecraft will travel to Dimorphos to demonstrate what NASA calls a kinetic impactor method. This method involves the spacecraft purposefully crashing into the asteroid at a high speed to change the object's motion in space. Lindley Johnson is NASA's planetary defense officer. He said in a statement, "This method is currently considered the most technologically mature way to redirect a possibly dangerous asteroid." After DART strikes Dimorphos, an investigative team will use telescopes on Earth and in space to measure how much the asteroid moved. Results of the test will then be examined so that scientists can create small impact experiments in a laboratory. The team will also use DART data to build new computer models in order to understand how such defensive impacts could affect a range of near-Earth objects. NASA says the DART mission is testing several new space technologies. One of them is a navigation system known as SmartNav, which permits the spacecraft to guide itself without operator assistance. Another new technology is a power-producing solar system that is expected to provide 3 times more electricity than similar systems used in the past. I'm Brian Lynn.
The Making of a Nation, a program in special English. I'm Kay Gallant. Today, Harry Monroe and I continue the story of America's Civil War.
By the autumn of 1864, it appeared that the North would defeat the South in the war between the states. The Southern Army needed men and supplies. There was little hope of getting enough of either to win. The Northern Army was stronger and better equipped, but it too had suffered. Much of the death and destruction was the result of new military technology.
A new kind of bullet had been invented. It was called the mini ball. It made the gun a much more deadly weapon. Before the mini ball, few soldiers could hit a target more than 30 meters away. With the new bullet, they could hit targets more than 150 meters away. Soldiers with such weapons could be put into position behind stone or earth walls. Then it was almost impossible to defeat them.
Most American generals, however, seemed unable to accept this. They continued to use the old methods of attack that had worked before the mini ball was invented. Hundreds or thousands of men were put in long lines across the front of the enemy position. A signal was given. The men began to march forward. When they got close, they fired their guns. Then they ran at the enemy and struck with their knives or hands. The idea was to shock the enemy, frighten him, and make him run away. As generals on both sides learned, this method no longer worked. The attackers were shot down before they could get close enough to hurt the defenders.
After 3.5 years of fighting, hundreds of thousands of Union and Confederate soldiers had been killed or wounded. Still, the war continued. In the East, Union armies were slowly pushing forward toward their main target. That was the Confederate capital at Richmond, Virginia. In the West, Union armies were slowly pushing deeper into Confederate territory. The Western armies were led by General William Sherman.
Sherman had 2 goals. One was to capture the city of Atlanta, Georgia. Atlanta was one of the few remaining industrial cities of the Confederacy. The other goal was to destroy the Confederate Army, led by General Joe Johnston. Sherman's army was stronger than Johnston's army, but the Confederates usually got into better defensive positions. Sherman refused to attack in such situations. it was easier to march around the Confederates and force them to withdraw. This happened again and again.
Confederate President Jefferson Davis began to believe that General Johnston was afraid to fight. He replaced him with another general. Within 2 days, that general attacked the Union Army. The attack began without enough planning. It was based on false information. It was a disaster. In 11 days of fighting, one-third of the Confederate Army in Georgia was destroyed. The remaining force was too weak to defend Atlanta. The city fell.
After capturing Atlanta, General Sherman fought a series of small battles with a Confederate force across northern Georgia. Then he decided to march to Savannah, a city on the Atlantic coast. Before leaving, his men set fire to the city. Almost all of Atlanta was destroyed. Sherman's army would continue to do this all the way to Savannah, Georgia, 350 kilometers away. It cut a path of destruction more than 100 kilometers wide. This campaign would be known as Sherman's March to the Sea.
Sherman said he wanted to make the people of Georgia suffer. He said he wanted to show the people of the Confederacy that their government could not protect them. Union soldiers stopped at every farm and village. They took food and clothing. They took horses, cows, and other farm animals. What they could not take or did not want, they destroyed. They set fire to houses and farm buildings. They burned crops. They destroyed stores and factories. They burned bridges and pulled up railroad tracks. Day by day, the Union Army of General William Sherman cut and burned its way across Georgia.
The army faced little opposition. Small groups of Confederate horse soldiers struck at the edges of the army, but they did little damage. On December 22, 1864, Sherman reached Savannah. He sent a message to President Abraham Lincoln in Washington. He said, "I beg to present you as a Christmas holiday gift the city of Savannah." Sherman's campaign had cut a great wound in the heart of the Confederacy. All that remained were the states of South Carolina, North Carolina, and Virginia. His march to the sea had a great destructive effect on the spirit of the South.
Sherman's army rested in Savannah for a month. Then, on February 1st, 1865, it began to move north. The goal was to join General Ulysses Grant outside the Confederate capital at Richmond, Virginia. As Sherman's army moved across South Carolina, it destroyed almost everything in sight. The soldiers remembered that South Carolina had been the first state to rebel and leave the Union. They remembered that South Carolina had fired the first shots of the war. This time, against orders, they destroyed the land they left behind. Confederate forces could not stop them.
The same thing happened in the Shenandoah River Valley northwest of Richmond. In the early years of the war, Confederate forces had moved through the valley to strike northern territory. They had invaded Maryland and Pennsylvania and had threatened Washington from there. General Grant decided that the Confederates had used the Shenandoah Valley long enough. He sent some of his men into the valley. He ordered them to destroy everything that might be of use to the enemy. "Eat up, Virginia," he said. "Clear and clean as far as you can go." Farms were burned. Crops were destroyed. Farm animals were taken away or killed. Nothing was left that could feed a man or animal. Nothing but blackened earth.
Then General Grant sent General Philip Sheridan into the Shenandoah Valley. Sheridan's army battled its way through the valley in the autumn of 1864. It gained victory after victory against a smaller, weaker Confederate force. By the end of the year, Union troops had complete control of the valley. The only Confederate power that remained was the army of General Robert E. Lee.
With the Shenandoah Valley closed to the Confederates, food supplies fell very low. There was almost nothing to feed the soldiers in Lee's army. Wagons would go out each day in search of food. They returned almost empty. More and more Confederate soldiers were running away. Some returned to their homes. Others surrendered to Union forces. Confederate leaders no longer could find soldiers to take the places of those who left. Men would not answer the Army's call. There was, however, a huge labor force in the South that the Army had not called. Slaves.
Slaves had been used to do non-military work for the Army. They had built roads and bridges. They had driven wagons. But they had not served as soldiers. In the North, thousands of free Negroes served in the Union Army, but they received less pay than white soldiers. Confederate lawmakers finally began to discuss the idea of using slaves as soldiers. A bill was proposed that would free any slave who joined the army to fight. Many Southern leaders opposed the bill, even if it would save the Confederacy. Said one, "Do not arm the slaves. The day you make them soldiers is the beginning of the end of the Revolution. If slaves make good soldiers, our whole idea of slavery is wrong."
General Robert E. Lee did not agree. He believed slaves could be made into good soldiers if they believed they had an interest in Confederate victory. He proposed giving immediate freedom to any slave who joined the army. The Confederate Congress passed a bill in March of 1865 to accept Negroes as soldiers. The bill did not promise to free them. By then, however, it was too late. An army of freed slaves could not be trained in time to save the Confederacy.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.